I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation on the internet model, fast and free all over the globe. Talking this hour about the Israel lobby, meaning the broad force inside the sturdy coalition of Washington and Jerusalem, meaning also the cautionary, if not downright hostile, analysis of the Israel lobby that was printed in London, posted on Harvard's Kennedy School site, and very widely read, debated, and by some denounced in a continuing storm on the web. The article was written by Professors Steve Walt of Harvard and John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, both of them foreign policy specialists of the so-called realist school. The one-sentence thrust of their piece could be summarized as saying that the pressures of the Israel lobby have bent the real interests of the U.S. in the Middle East, maybe even the real interests of Israel, out of shape. Perhaps the only point of agreement among our guests this hour is that Walt Mearsheimer argument needs a broader discussion and debate than it's getting, especially in the U.S. mainstream. Please enter the conversation through the gateway of our website, www.radioopensource.org. We're reading the mail as we go. Steve Clemens runs the American Strategy Program at the New American Foundation in Washington, and he blogs at the Washington Note. Steve, you live in those corridors of power among the think tanks and the policy wonks. I wish you'd start out by just giving us your kernel of the Walt Mearsheimer piece as Washington reads it.
Well, Steve Walt and John Mearsheimer's piece created a small earthquake here because, to some degree, they have surfaced concerns that some in the foreign policy field have had about America's close relationship with Israel and have tried to articulate what that relationship looks like, what its contours are. But what's happened in D.C. is I would say there's been a very mixed reaction, that on one hand, most people half the people believe that Walt and Mearsheimer have engaged in a reckless and somewhat sloppy exercise that's led to sort of more jingoism and kind of strident American pugnaciousness in these issues rather than, steadied debate. And the other half thinks, wow, this was a brave move, and they're articulating something that somebody needed to say, and maybe now we'll have a more reasonable and fair and intelligent discussion, which we're trying to do on your show today. But it's definitely sparked passions on both sides. And I think what's interesting is most people who are reacting haven't read the paper at all. One version of it appeared in London Review of Books. Another much, much longer version appeared through the Kennedy School. And I would say that most people are already, pontificating and offering prognostications on either the merits or failings of the Mearsheimer-Walt argument, haven't even read the piece.
You say half the people or half the reaction could be characterized as saying it's sloppy and reckless. I mean, flagrantly so?
Well, I would say that a lot of people, one of my own qualms about the paper is that you've tried to come up with a bumper sticker. Pat Choate, who wrote the book The Agents of Influence about the Japanese lobby at the end of the 1980s, ran into this as well, where you try to sort of tell a story about another government's access to American lobbying machinery. And they depict it, in quotes, as the lobby, rather than just saying it's, this is, we're talking about AIPAC, or, giving more sophisticated treatment to a diverse and not monolithic Jewish and Israeli-concerned set of institutions and players in American politics. So a lot of them see, there's some inaccuracies that have been pointed out in the paper. I'm not that familiar with the inaccuracies, but there have been some that Steve Walt and others have acknowledged. But, it's one of those papers that anyone writing this would have known that every word would have been combed through so carefully,
right,
that what's happened is you now have a debate about the debate rather than a debate about the issues. And people end up, turning off their mind to some of the questions because of the fact that they've been able to, pull, a thread out of some smaller point that Mearsheimer and Walt said. But the biggest flaw, I think, is that they've tried to create a bumper sticker out of a very complex debate saying the lobby is insidious and directing, you know, American foreign policy and national security decisions in directions that they ought not to go. And I think that's a very, very important subject, and it's probably not just a lobby or a monolithic block that we need to be discussing.
Let me just explain a couple things. First of all, we're interested in the issue, not the debate around the debate.
Sure.
Why Steve Wald is no longer the academic dean or at the Kennedy School or tra-la-la. That's another, you know, whole set of red herrings, I think. And there's enough to talk about here in the subject itself. The thrust of it, though, take a crack at it. The argument is that the alliance with Israel is not, as it's often said to be, a matter of geopolitical strategy. Neither is it satisfying as a kind of moral championship of a beleaguered people. How does that play in the Washington talk?
Well, what
at your
Walt,
water coolers?
Yeah, what Walt and Mearsheimer are articulating is that the lobbying group that ostensibly represents Israel's interests, and to some degree the American Jewish communities, though not by means all of it, in AIPAC. AIPAC is a good sort of placeholder for that debate, is that AIPAC is extremely strong, extremely influential. Jewish political giving in the United States is enormously high and higher than any other major ethnic group in the United States on basis of population. It is a group with clout. And AIPAC itself, if you were to sort of roughly describe AIPAC's preferences, tends to affiliate with what would have looked like the former Sharon-led Likud government, which was much more aggressive in terms of trying to either unilaterally set Israel's borders or essentially keep the Palestinian side of their equation off balance permanently. And that direction is one that's been problematic, particularly as the Middle East has risen to be of enormous significance to, you know, broad American foreign policy goals. So anyone that wants to talk about either Iraq or Iran or a Saudi future or dealing with Egypt, at the end of the day, if you're going to look at a Middle East project, you've got to build in the Israeli-Palestinian situation into that, because it lies so much as sort of a festering ulcer under a much of the sympathies and views of many Muslim Arabs. So they have basically said that the lobby, AIPAC, et cetera, have kept America from engaging in enlightened, you know, policies in its own interest that would be more enlightened and more consistent with a sophisticated and successful American strategy in the Middle East. And so they look at that, the impact of that lobby as being quite un-American, quite contrary to American interests. What I think is important and interesting, as I mentioned to one of your producers earlier, I've just come back from Israel. I was there.
I want to get to that.
Do you want me to go into it now?
Well, perhaps. I'd like finish up the point you were on. And let me also just say parenthetically that Steve Wald has been on this program before. We know John Mearsheimer a little bit. We, of course, asked them both if they wanted to talk about their paper. I think they're very happy to let other people kick it around. And, you know, they'll let the dust settle first.
Yeah,
so neither are we looking sort of for a final disposition of this case. But what's striking about you and Daniel Levy and Daniel Dresner is that everybody on the roster today thinks there's stuff here to talk about. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Steve Clements, I'd like you to touch on this matter of the timeliness of it. There's a new government in Israel.
Right.
There's Washington is still kind of dazed by the disappointment, if not debacle, in Iraq. Why do you call this the particular moment of urgency for this discussion?
Well, everything seems to be just a little bit different than it used to be quite blunt. We've just had an election in Israel that moved, I think, in a surprising direction, where you essentially have a center-left government in place. You've had an election on the Palestinian side, which, of course, made quite clear what was unclear before, is that, you know, the majority of sympathies in the among Palestinian voters are frustrated with a corrupt Fatah government and have put in place Hamas, which is hostile to Israel. But rather than pushing the one extreme will create another extreme button in the Israeli politics is, you know, Israel essentially rejected the Likud and, to some degree, in my view, rejected a strong, you know, hard right government. And most people look at this as an opportunity, that if somehow you can bring around this seemingly intractable and hostile Hamas and find the optics and tectonics to make that work, you can really solve something. Whereas before, you were never quite sure with the previous controllers of that government whether or not they really controlled the machinery of violence, the machinery of terrorism on the Palestinian side, and whether you could really organize and cut a deal. I think that at the same time, you had 3 weeks ago AIPAC's annual policy conference in Washington. This conference took on it took place while I was in Israel. And some of the headliners, whom you know well, were Richard Perle, John Bolton, our ambassador to the United Nations, Richard Cheney, our vice president, and they set a highly strident tone, particularly about Iran. And they were met with standing ovations, repeated ovations, and it was... And it
ovations from AIPAC. How did it play in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv?
Well, what's very interesting is that the folks that I was meeting, whether they were in the Likud or hardliners in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or some current and former Mossad officials, as well as advisors to Prime Minister Olmert, now who will be the real Prime Minister Olmert rather than the acting Prime Minister, all of them told me that what was going on with AIPAC in this AIPAC conference was far too strident, far too shrill, undermined the flexibility that Israel wanted in dealing with factors like Iran. And I found this quite surprising gap that I had been really shocked by.
Hold it there, Steve. We're going to come back to this question of what may be a mismatch between the Israel lobby and Israel. We're talking about the Israel lobby, not only the political force, but the article about it by Steve Walt and John Mearsheimer. We'll be back. This is Open Source.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the Open Source blogger-in-chief. This weekend, Henry got in touch with several angry young Frenchmen. They shared with us pictures of the French labor protest, including one of a Gaul, the ancient kind of Gaul, with a sign telling Dominique de Villepin to resign. You can read their emails on the site. Also, Catherine has been collecting stories from immigrants around the country. We will be talking to them on air soon. If you've got a story, add it at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the Israel lobby and the article of the same name in the London Review of Books, available on the Harvard Kennedy School website. Daniel Levy joins us from New York. He's an Israeli and an activist. He's the policy and international director of the Geneva Initiative, which you can explain if you will, Dan Levy. But he's also a contributor to the online daily newspaper Haaretz. You wrote a fascinating and not terribly unkind critique of the Walt Mearsheimer piece, Daniel Levy, and it's been, again, on the TPM Cafe, generating a whole lot of commentary on its own. Give the listeners first a taste of your take on the article, and then the response you've had.
Well, I would really take it from where Steve left off on a couple of things that Steve Clemens mentioned. And one is that my take on this article was the need to have the debate. And for me, it seemed an obvious thing coming from Israel. There's a very, very healthy, vibrant, critical, self-critical, open debate that goes on in Israel, reflected, for instance, as you mentioned, in the pages of Haaretz and in the article I wrote there. And it seemed to me that there's something deeply unhealthy about not having the space for that debate here. The other thing that I think was my point of departure is this question of, are we on the same page?
Israel and Washington.
No, actually, what I was referring to is Israel and those who claim to speak in the name of the good of Israel.
Okay.
Over here. What we've seen with this article, I think, and I don't want to go into what I felt was a somewhat polemical take in the article. As an Israeli who cares deeply about Israel, I found the article jarring, but I also found that it raised some issues that need to be raised. Amongst those issues, I'd say, is that Israel is now in a place where we are grappling, and it's not simple, we're grappling with how do you unravel the occupation. The elections that took place less than a week ago in Israel, I think, gave a clear mandate for a policy that will entail a significant further evacuation on the West Bank. The exact contours and exactly how that will be done unilaterally or by agreement will be determined, I believe, in the next year, in the next 4 years, during the term of the coming government. That's not simple. That's going to require nuance and sophistication. And to the extent to which we can have an open debate, I think that's going to be easier, and it's going to encourage and take that process forward. And to the extent to which you use sledgehammer policies, and to which there's perhaps an overzealousness, that's going to be unhelpful to Israel. So for me, it was the line in the study that said, and this was almost an afterthought in the study perhaps, that said that this may also not be in Israel's interest, that really caught my attention.
Where would you begin the debate if you were addressing the Council of Foreign Relations, as you do, or speaking on the Yale campus? Where would you ask Americans in general to start rethinking? What is it that has to be rethought?
I'd start, first of all, by saying, have the debate. Don't use intimidatory tactics. I don't think that organizations like Campus Watch, established by Daniel Pipes, really have a legitimate role in this if they're trying to police academia and trying to police the debate. And I think that's unhelpful to Israel, unhelpful to the debate here in the States. So first of all, let's put that behind us. Secondly, let's look at what it will actually take to bring Israel forward to peace and security. I'll give you a snapshot of something that happened in the Israeli election that I think demonstrates what I am arguing here. The Likud, and some people have seen some of the organizations, and I just want to affirm that the lobby with a capital L is not a monolith. I think it's mistaken to see it as such. I also would like to point out that the majority of American Jewish opinion, actually, when it's polled, and it is polled frequently, shows that people take moderate, pragmatic positions when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian debate, as they do with most other issues. But if you look at the election campaign that just took place in Israel, it's fascinating. The Likud party, which has now shrunk to a puny 12 seats out of the 120 seats in the Israeli Knesset, ran three phases to their campaign. And indulge me for a moment to tell you what those were.
Please.
The first phase was a campaign that said the 67 lines with a kind of hazy, scary picture of Ehud Olmert, who they were running against, of course, and he's now the PM designate. The idea being, this guy's going to take us back to the 67 lines, isn't this awful? They withdrew and changed those billboards after 1 week because people really were not sure whether this was a positive campaign for Olmert or a negative scare campaign. Israelis apparently are ready for those kind of territorial concessions. The second phase of their campaign came after the Hamas election victory, and the slogan was, strong against the Hamas, with a picture of Netanyahu, the Likud leader, looking strong. Again, it didn't wash. rather than Israelis saying, wow, yeah, we're scared, they said, well, if these people are in government and the polls showed, maybe we have to deal with them. And in polling, you consistently saw about 50% of Israelis saying, well, maybe we have to talk to the new guys who are in power.
That's the fascinating. Could I mention, though, two other points, Daniel Levy, that you mentioned, you touched on in your Haaretz piece, and I wonder if you want to do now, which were broadly, in terms of the Israel lobby, rethink the marriage with the neocons and rethink the marriage with the Christian conservatives. Do they belong in this debate, those points?
I think to collapse Israeli interests and the agenda that the neocons have been promoting would be a terrible mistake. And to the extent to which that has been done, I think we should now be trying to unravel and reverse that. I would argue, and here I perhaps take issue with the authors of the report, that I'm not sure which is the tail and which is the dog. Who's calling the shots here? Who's using who? I think it's been very convenient for the neocons to piggyback. I would think it's fair to mention here to piggyback on AIPAC. So number one, I'd say to the extent to which a Gordian knot has been established there, cut it. The other one is the Christian right. And here, I must admit, I'm speaking as someone who's deeply concerned. And here I believe I'm echoing the majority of American Jewish opinion, who is deeply concerned that one makes alliances like that. When Pat Robertson turned round and said that the terrible physical distress and coma that our Prime Minister is now in, outgoing Prime Minister Sharon, was God's punishment for leaving Gaza, I can't have truck with people who are saying that. And I think it was a terrible mistake to work with the Christian right.
Steve Clemens, you were the American in Israel while Daniel Levy is the Israeli visiting us. But you were just speaking about what Likud and Olmert people were saying in response to Vice President Cheney's speech to AIPAC. I mean, what isn't Dick Cheney hearing about the nuance and sophistication inside Israeli politics that Daniel Levy's just explained?
Well, one of the things that was most fascinating from those voices in Israel that I heard was that they thought that AIPAC was far too shrill and was creating realities that were confining Israel's options. And so what I would, you know, to reframe that, you said, what is Cheney not hearing? Cheney's not hearing the authentic Israeli voice, the diversity of it, and with particular focus on Iran, which was much the subject of the AIPAC conference. One of the really astounding things, if anyone spends any time in Jerusalem around the Knesset or the government crowd there and then comes back to Washington, there is a sophistication about Iran in Israel which was astounding to me, about a confidence that Israel has pretty good sense of what is real and what is not in Iran, a sense that Ahmadinejad, in the case of some of the anti-Israel rhetoric and anti-Jewish rhetoric that Ahmadinejad made, that they get a sense that Ahmadinejad may be confined in time by factors that are in domestic Iran. There was just a depth of understanding about Iran, which in part comes from Israel's old strong alliance 25 years ago with Iran. But also, I think one of the things that was most interesting, because I was talking to a lot of people in the intelligence area, is that Israel clearly has a much, much better human intelligence network than the United States does. So what I found fascinating was how frustrated national security officials in Israel were by the ratcheting up of hyperventilating rhetoric out of the AIPAC conference, because I don't think Israel is ready at all to proceed with a harsh, hot intervention in Iran, neither to support one nor to participate in one.
Steve Clemens, I want to come back to this.
Yeah,
not only the
not
harsh intervention in Iran, but the afterthoughts on the harsh intervention in Iraq. We've got to deal with both of those things, but I want to introduce Daniel Dresner, political scientist at the University of Chicago, also a celebrated blogger who writes about globalization, pop culture, economics, as well as his professional specialty. You've written about the Walt Mearsheimer Article 2, Dan Dresner. Give us your take.
In one sentence, what's true about it isn't new, and what's new about it is not necessarily true. I think that Walton Mearsheimer should be applauded, as I said, for raising the issue of, in the first place, of whether or not U.S. policy in the Middle East has been affected by, you know, domestic interest groups, most obviously AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups. And I think to argue that U.S. policy hasn't been affected by those groups would border on the absurd. At the same time, the paper argues that these groups are almost entirely, that's exactly what they say, almost entirely responsible for U.S. policy in the Middle East. And that's such a massive overstatement that I actually think the paper will probably not advance the debate that we should be having any further. And I think that's an unfortunate fact.
Certainly understates what everybody thinks was the oil motive in the war in Iraq. But what about, how do you hear this disconnect that both Daniel Levy and Steve Clemens are talking about between Israel and the Israel lobby in this country?
I think there are two factors, and both of which have to do with sort of the way domestic politics works in the United States. The first is that in a lot of ethnic lobbies in the United States, you have some more extreme groups often running the show, as it were. I mean, if you take a look, if you were to poll Cuban emigres, for example, on the U.S. embargo of Cuba, my guess is that most Cubans adopt a relatively moderate position, and some might even favor lifting the embargo. That said, none of those people are running CANF, which is the primary anti-Castro lobby that's influential in Florida and in Washington, D.C. I think you're seeing a similar, you know, effect at work in terms of AIPAC. The second part of this, which Daniel Levy referred to, is the sort of link between supporting Israel is not just for Jews anymore, would be the way to put it, which is that it's Christian evangelicals in this country that are responsible for a lot of the political weight behind U.S. policy towards Israel.
Does that make the lobby good for Israel or not? Or does it just make it sort of part of the larger fabric of the way American politics works?
I think whether it's good for Israel is for Israelis to decide, and I'm certainly not one of them. I think the better question to ask, and I think the question Walton Mearsheimer supposedly wanted to ask, is whether or not it's good for the United States. And, you know, you can argue that all interest groups, you know, potentially affect U.S. foreign policy in ways that deviate from what Walton Mearsheimer would consider the national interest. Of course, there are other lobbying groups that want to push the U.S. dramatically in a different direction. And that's one of the problems with the paper, is that those groups don't seem to exist in this paper.
Dan Dresner, you make a very cute little point in your response, and I hope I can summarize it. But basically, you say that this is a kind of correction after the Iraq invasion. People like Mearsheimer and Walt simply can't imagine why in the world the United States government ever made this mistake, and Sherlock Holmes has to come up with an answer. And in this case, they've settled on the Israeli lobby. Israel lobby.
Right. Well, as you pointed out at the beginning, at the top of the show, Steve Walt and John Mearsheimer are what would be considered within international relations theory hardcore realists, which is they believe that, you know, states function or governments function as unitary actors acting in the national interest. Now, Mearsheimer has admitted in other fora that realism cannot explain why the U.S. invaded Iraq. And it's true that most realists within the academy opposed the Iraq War of 2003. And normatively, you know, they can probably derive some satisfaction from the aftermath of the conflict. The question, however, if you're a good social scientist, is if realism can't explain this, then why did we do it in the first place?
Right.
And their answer to that is it must be this lobby. I think there are a lot of other answers out there, and they don't really entertain any of them in the paper.
But we'll come back to them.
Yeah.
This is Open Source. Brendan Greeley is our blogmeister. And it's been an active page out there, Brendan. What do you hear?
Well, Mr. Dana logged in earlier this afternoon. He's an American Jew. He's moving to Israel. And he wrote, "I feel the most fundamental problem that Israel faces today is from American Jews." He, for example, believes that AIPAC is going to make Israel dependent on U.S. support forever. He even goes so far as to call AIPAC a fundamentally anti-Zionist organization for that reason. But more generally, he writes that to American Jews, Israel isn't a country. It's an aspect of Jewish identity. He writes that American Jews are unable to fully understand the complex nature and fabric of Israeli society. Is that true? Is that part of the problem?
I think that's a question for Daniel Levy first. British-born, a citizen of Israel, Daniel.
I immigrated to Israel 15 years ago. I think that's probably a fair criticism, but I think it would not be unique to the relationship between the Jewish diaspora and Israel to other diasporas. And I think Dan Dresner raised that point earlier. Where it can have a damaging effect is, does it hold us, and when I say us here, I mean Israel and the international community and American policy, back from doing the right thing? I'll give you an example. Right now you have an Israeli government that's apparently willing and ready to withdraw from, let's say, 90% of the West Bank. You apparently have Palestinian public and leaders ready for a permanent peace if it's 100%. Can we bridge the gap? Would American engagement allow Israelis and Palestinians move to a new place where they have agreed, recognized borders and can live in peace? Now, if America could play that role, and something's going to prevent America from playing that role, then it begins to enter the realm of things that are unhelpful for Israel.
Daniel Dresner, can you imagine AIPAC or the Israel lobby, so-called, being that powerful and that obstructive?
No. I actually can't. If Israel's government winds up supporting, you know, if a peace deal along the lines of what Daniel Levy was alluding to, and, you know, somewhat around the contours of what was proposed, I think, in 2000, was agreed upon and Israel's government supported it, I think it would be, AIPAC would be very hard-pressed to somehow oppose the deal and actually have any influence over American foreign policy after that fact. On the other hand, I mean, not being in D.C., Steve Clemens might be better placed to answer that than me. But, I mean, it is worth pointing out, I will say, in the past, that administrations in the past have taken on AIPAC, the most famous one being the first Bush administration, Bush 41, in forcing Israel to go to talks in Madrid. And AIPAC was virulently opposed to it, and Bush still insisted on going ahead.
And what does that tell you?
It tells me that, again, the Israel lobby, it tells me that Walt and Mearsheim are, to some extent, are trying to use a constant to explain a variable, which is they're trying to explain the omnipresence of this Israel lobby to explain U.S. policy towards Israel, and U.S. policy towards Israel has fluctuated over time. And so it's not clear to me at all that their cause is what's actually going on.
It might also have been a very cautionary, important lesson for the younger George W. Bush as to how he would manage those pressures too, no? Hold on, we're going to take a short break and come back to all of these questions, plus the Iraq aftermath and the Iran prelude, we hope not. We're talking about the Israel lobby, the pressure group, and the article. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the Israel lobby. The article called the Israel lobby by two rather prominent American political scientists, John Mearsheimer of Chicago, Steve Walt of Harvard, and about the lobby itself. It is, of course, vastly more than a political power base. I wonder, Daniel Dresner, if you can sort of unpeel some of the points that Mr. Dana on our blog suggested. Relationships of American Jews, some religious, some secular, some political, some not, some young, some old, but their relationship with Israel, in fact and in idea. Can anybody explain briefly what the range of things it means to the American piece of the diaspora?
Okay, no pressure.
You're up to it, man.
As an American Jew who has not been to Israel, it might be difficult for me to answer that question. I can tell you, for example, growing up, obviously, and as someone who went to Hebrew school, you know, you were graduated from the Hebrew high school as well as an American high school. You know, you were one of the things that was thought to be part of being a Jew was, in fact, going to Israel and sort of seeing the country, as it were. However, the problem is that when you talk about American Jews, it's a very diverse group of people,
right.
Both in terms of religious practice and in terms of cultural identity. Some Jews, you know, consider themselves very devout and, you know, would qualify as, I guess, having the preferences of what Steve Clemens would call Likud. At the same time, there are a lot of Jews who are completely secular, don't practice, and don't necessarily have the kind of identity with Israel that you know, Walter Mearsheimer are claiming that some Jews have.
Anybody want to gild that lily? Daniel Levy?
Yeah, I just want to jump in and clarify that I'm not saying that if an Israeli government takes a decision and makes a bold peace move, that mainstream groups here would stand in the way and prevent that. What I'm saying is that they sometimes narrow and limit the options and the choices that exist for policy. And I'll give you an example that I think is a very important example right now. Israel is grappling with how we deal with a Hamas-led Palestinian Authority and with the cohabitation between President Abbas and Hamas in government. The Palestinian Authority employs about 150,000 people, has a working budget of $165 million a month. It's not in Israel's interest for those people to suddenly fall off the payroll and for the 60,000 members of the Palestinian security forces to go without pay. Chaos and anarchy over there could have a terribly dramatic impact on Israel's security. And Israel's trying to find sophisticated ways of how one can work through that problem. The kind of resolutions that are working through Congress right now, there's an initiative by Lantos and Ross Lehtinen, limit what our options are. And that's what I'm pointing out, that sometimes an overzealous sledgehammer approach on an issue that's requires incredible subtlety and nuance and incredibly complex is deeply unhelpful. And that's the position I'm trying to point out.
But how do you measure the reaction on American campuses in an American establishment when you say, listen here, I'm from Israel and I'm telling you that, you know, the lobby can't be your only source here. What comes back at you?
What I'm saying to people is don't leave your critical faculties for thought behind when it comes to Israel. If you feel passionately about Israel, and I encourage people to get involved and get engaged and feel passionate about Israel, then embrace what is the healthy debate that's going on in Israel and take a position on it. And don't blindly follow a position that you're given. And I'll tell you, some people kick back and say, no, we have to support Israel. We don't wash our dirty laundry in public. That's not helpful. And some people say, thank you. We've been waiting for that voice. We haven't found our place. And actually, we've simply turned our back on the whole debate. What I hear from students time and again, including last night at Yale, there was an incredibly intelligent woman in that audience. She had been chair of the College Democrats. And she said to me, I didn't know what to do with myself in this debate because I felt that if I got involved, either I had to take on board hook, line and sinker everything they were telling me, and I didn't feel comfortable with that. And yet, of course, I didn't want to join the anti-Israel brigade because I'm not there at all. And there's a place that you can feel comfortable having a critical debate, caring about Israel, loving Israel, caring about Israel's security interests, but following essentially what half of the Israeli public are saying and what probably a majority of the members of the next Israeli government are going to be saying, which is this occupation is bad for Israel. It's bad for our security. It's bad for our morality. It's bad for our interests. We need out.
When does it become dirty laundry is the puzzle.
Well, if I may, Chris, I think...
Dan Dresner, please.
No, this is Steve.
That's actually Steve Clemens.
Sorry.
I think one of the issues that I think will take us towards the Iraq question, but it gets to what Dan said about how do you explain, you know, varying circumstances as Walt Mearsheimer with a constant factor. And the fact is you really can't. One of the things, though, that is important is that in this administration, George Bush's administration, You've had a very heavy investment by the Israeli government and by AIPAC in a certain number of key officials. I asked this question throughout my trip. Did they feel that they were investing heavily in Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz, in Scooter Libby, and in these relationships? And do they feel that they over-invested in those relationships? One gentleman who said his comments were on the record was a former Israeli ambassador to Turkey, which next to the United States is considered to be Israel's second most important ambassadorial post, a very distinguished guy who is close to all of these gentlemen. And he says, yes, maybe we have overinvested in these people, but these are high-stakes times in global affairs, and we needed our American friends, and we did invest deeply in, you know, the so-called neoconservatives. And so to some degree, it's not surprising that the Walt Mearsheimer paper came out now in some degree as a reaction to this kind of bolder and more strident relationship with a few key individuals within this Bush administration, which really hasn't existed in the same depth and in the same effectiveness as it has even in the Clinton administration. I don't know how Dan
take a crack at that. And then I want to get back to the between Iraq and Iran question. Dan Dresner.
I mean, I think, this gets back to an interesting debate, which is, it gets back to the neocon influence over the decision to invade Iraq. And, we had this debate 2 years ago in this country as well. It wasn't talked, had less to do with the lobby, quote unquote, but it was the extent of the neocon influence. And, I mean, I think there are two things that are worth pointing out. The first is that I don't think that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, or Don Rumsfeld were ever identified as neoconservatives, and to call them, so weak-willed as to listen to sort of the whisperings of people like Wolfowitz and Libby sounds a little bit odd. I mean, they deserve, a fair amount of criticism for a variety of things, but being weak-willed isn't one of them. The second thing, and this points to a potential motivation for writing the paper, is that there was a debate within the country about whether or not we should go to war with Iraq, and to some extent the neocons won the sort of argument, the rhetorical argument, the realist lost. And so you have to wonder, to some extent, what is is this sour grapes driving this sort of argument? Now,
well, the realist lost, and then they won again, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, but the fact that they lost the first time around does prompt, a question of, well, how did that happen? It must be because this lobby is so powerful, not because necessarily the ideas that they proposed were at all compelling.
Well, in that sense, I'd like all three of you to kind of set this Walt Mearsheimer article in the framework of hindsight on Iraq. Francis Fukuyama is out sort of forswearing his neocon past, and that argument in a certain way is still, among the citizens, Dan Dresner, that's still just dawning, really, that there was a neocon logic to that whole thing. But then furthermore, we're somewhere between blowback on Iraq and run-up on Iran, and it seems to me that's where this article sort of falls. How do we take it?
Well, it's worth comparing and contrasting the administration's approach to Iran and Iraq, the run-ups. I mean, the run-up to Iraq was your classic, to some extent, had a much more neocon flavor to it. It was relatively, willingness to proceed without the United Nations. Daniel Levy speaks about the sort of crudeness of the rhetoric from AIPAC. I think it's safe to say that if you take a look at the Bush administration's rhetoric on a whole lot of positions, it's been pretty crude. So it's not clear that Israel is being singled out there. And it was certainly the case in terms of dealing with Iraq before the war. On the other hand, the approach on Iran has been much more, the sort of speeches at AIPAC aside, the approach on Iran has been much more subtle. There's been a willingness to work through the IAEA, a willingness to get the UN Security Council on board. There have been repeated negotiations among the permanent five members, in part, I think, because it's not clear what the end game is going to be on Iran.
But that's a big aside, a big parenthesis, isn't it, when you say AIPAC speeches aside? I mean, it was in red-hot meetings like that that the whole Iraq deal was laid out. And a lot of people didn't believe it and so didn't really take notice. I mean, shouldn't we take notice of Bolton, Cheney, and Pearl flexing their muscles?
Let me put it this way. If we wind up engaging in a unilateral invasion of Iran, I will
eat all of my words and concede to Walt and Mearsheimer that the Israel lobby clearly must exist. I don't think that's going to happen, though.
Daniel Levy, what do you think? I mean, fit this in your own sort of retrospective on Iraq and your, you know, your whatever foreshadowings you feel about Iran.
I would categorically say that there was not an AIPAC conspiracy to take America to war with Iraq that tipped the scales. I don't think that's what was going on. I think they ended up being part of an echo chamber that they were drawn into. I'll give you an Israeli angle on this, which may surprise some people and be interesting. Israel clearly was not opposing, and many Israelis felt that engaging in a war with Iraq was the right thing to do and was good for Israeli security. However, there was a debate. It didn't surface greatly, but it was very much taking place within the Israeli security establishment, and it said the following. The strategic threat is Iran, not Iraq. We may limit and actually undermine what we can do in Iran if we go for what some people have called the wrong war. Now, those voices may not have been heard very publicly, but they were heard inside the security establishment, and they're increasingly being heard today.
Interesting. That certainly was not the voice of Prime Minister Sharon or his government. I mean, can you name the kinds of people who were saying not this one, but the next one maybe?
I'll tell you what the Israeli current Army Chief of Staff said a few weeks ago. He said, we may well miss Saddam Hussein. What you have today is rather than Iraq being an exporter of democracy to the region, it's an exporter of terror to the region. And the base in Iraq has now been used to launch attacks in Jordan and attacks in the Sinai Peninsula. For anyone not familiar with the geography, both of those are getting dangerously close to Israel's border. On Iran, if I may, what I would say is that maybe a missing ingredient here is having a more active American presence, if not around the table when the European three have been sitting with the Iranians, then at least giving the Europeans more rope to work with. I heard former German foreign minister, who until very recently was very involved in these talks, Joschka Fischer, saying that he felt that what they needed and they didn't have to break the impasse was an American commitment that if the Iranians came on board, America would say, we will stop playing regime change in Iran. In other words, the position until now has been, if you come on board, then we're still going for regime change. I don't know if that was what would get us through the impasse. I'm perhaps skeptical, but I think it's worth thinking about.
Dan Dresner, did you want to jump in?
I actually did on one point, which is, again, it's to distinguish sort of parts about the paper, which is about democracy promotion within the region. The fact that the Army Chief of Staff, you know, said maybe we would prefer the devil we know rather than the devil we don't, suggests, again, the distinctions between Israel's interests and the sort of larger ideas that neoconservatism has in the United States. I don't think that the idea of democracy promotion in the region was ever really a fundamental, you know, sort of driver of the, quote, Israel lobby, unquote. It's far from clear that that would necessarily advance Israel's interests.
And yet the paper does make it pretty clear that the Sharon government was encouraging, to put it mildly, the Bush invasion against Saddam, no? And the major figures in the so-called Israel lobby, too.
They've got a lot of quotes saying to that effect. I agree with Daniel Levy, though, that I think there was a much bigger debate going on within Israel about whether this was the right war to get involved with. This is, again, one of the paradoxes of the Israel lobby, as it seems to me. On the one hand, they're apparently an all-powerful, all-seeing, extremely well-organized force in terms of domestic politics in the United States, and yet apparently they're relatively inept in terms of trying to judge what is in the best interest of Israel in the region in the Middle East.
Steve Clements, I think it's for you to sort of wrap up the meaning and the timing of this article and whatever is worthy in it at this moment in American diplomacy, maybe military history, between Iraq and we pray not, but Iran.
I think President Bush has been chastened by his experience in Iraq. And I think that I disagree with Dan Dresner and to some degree Daniel Levy that whether or not Israel was driving our direction on Iraq, there were many Israel-concerned U.S. government officials who had great concern and used that as part of their consciousness and rationale for the direction that they lobbied for. And they did lobby. It was a competition. But I think after 9/11 and as the war got going, President Bush and essentially neoconservatives were largely at the helm of U.S. foreign policy. I think President Bush's foreign policy soul is out for bid again. And you have inside the Bush administration a deep debate, a sometimes vicious debate, between what increasingly looks like a kind of pro-engagement, pro-international law, surprisingly, direction that Condi Rice is taking, her crowd of not really realists, but sort of, you know, ethical realists, versus the kind of Dick Cheney-led group inside the administration that has what I would still say the, you know, Iraq mold defining most of their direction. And I think President Bush, as I said, is out for bid again. And we're going to see this competition. And I think in part, you know, now that you have AIPAC officials under investigation by the FBI and the State Department case involving Larry Franklin, you've got a chastened America after having, you know, sort of, you know, run into a sandbank in Iraq, that you've got a new debate. And I think the Walt Mearsheimer paper is an extremely important provocative piece in this debate to decide where
we're going
to go.
Let's hope that the whole debate will open up and that this is just the beginning. I wonder, in 30 seconds, Daniel Levy, how can you open up a conversation between Israel's goals as you feel them and those of the Israel lobby?
You should import the debate that's going on in Israel, make people here more aware of the differences, the nuances, the diversity of that debate inside Israel. I would urge moderate American Jews and the organizations, and they exist and they're out there, to speak out. And I don't think that this is a question that AIPAC is always going to be pushing a certain agenda. The majority of people who work for and donate to AIPAC care about Israel, and they will want Israel to have peace and have security, and that debate could be brought forward.
Daniel Levy, thank you enormously for joining us. Thank you, Dan Dresner. Thank you, Steve Clemens. You can keep talking about the Israel lobby in tonight's program. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and by WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Landmine Survivors Network, offering health, opportunities, and rights to mine victims worldwide. www.landminesurvivors.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murs, and Robin Amer, with help from Greta Pemberton and Henry Shepard. Mike Wilkins was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.